Hi, Dave Emmer here. This is For the Record, program number 1046, interview number 15 with Jim DiEugenio about Destiny Betrayed. This is being recorded on January 8th of the year 2019. And once again, it is my pleasure and my privilege to be joined by Jim DiEugenio, the author of, among other titles, Destiny Triumphal, Destiny Betrayed, an analysis not only of the JFK assassination, but in particular Jim New Orleans, DA Jim Garrison's investigation of same. Jim, welcome back once again to our airwaves.
Good evening, Dave.
As we proceed into Jim Garrison's investigation of and eventually trial of Clay Shaw, bearing in mind that both CIA in-house expert Ray Rocha felt that Jim Garrison would get the conviction of Clay Shaw, and Jonathan Blackmer. the assistant counsel for the House Select Committee on Assassinations, also felt that basically Clay Shaw was either one of the planners of or a cutout to the planners of the assassination. In your book and in our last several interviews and in the interviews we'll be doing today and probably next week, I think an encapsulated analysis that really goes to the fundamental importance of what you have laid out for us in Destiny Betrayed is set forth by you on pages 228 and 229, and I'm going to offer a conditional apology both to you and to the audience for reading as much as I'm about to do, but I think this really goes to the essence of the importance of, or one of the major important elements of your book, and really its significance for our society. On pages 228 and 229, you write, and by the way, de Torres here is Bernardo de Torres, longtime intelligence veteran, very possibly present in Dealey Plaza on the day of the assassination, linked to the assassination of Orlando Letelier, very possibly involved with the killing of Eladio Del Valle and others, and one of the infiltrators in the Garrison's investigation. About Oswald, de Torres said he knew he had not killed Kennedy because de Torres knew the people who were actually involved, and they were talking about it before it happened. I have detailed the de Torres penetration at length, that's penetration into Garrison's investigation at length, since it is important in order to understand what really happened to Jim Garrison, and also to reveal just how much was at stake for suspects like Bernardo de Torres and his allies. As Gaetan Fonzi notes in his book, and as the author found out from an interview, when Victor Marchetti, parenthetically a former CIA officer, was executive assistant to CIA Director Richard Helms, Helms would run staff meetings about agency operations. During these meetings, Marchetti would take the official notes. At times, Helms would indicate he wanted certain things not taken down. At other times, something would come up and Helms would cut off any follow-up by waving his hand. He then would add that this subject would be pursued further in his office or in the proper deputy's office, with Marchetti not there to take notes. Marchetti said that the Garrison inquiry and the Shaw trial came up more than once. Each time, Helms would ask what they were doing to help the defense. Fonzi later found out that de Torres' penetration was only the inception of the CIA's effort to torpedo Garrison. For the House Select Committee on Assassinations, later discovered through CIA documents that there were 9 undercover agents at one time or another in Garrison's office. So in addition to what Mr. King, that is a Denver oil man whom we spoke of last week, had warned Garrison about, that is the negativity of the media, which would now plague him until the end, there was something that King left unsaid. But after he left, Assistant Andrew Chiambra noted it to Garrison. He said, quote, "Well, they offered you the carrot, and you turned it down. You know what's coming next, don't you?" What we are about to describe in this chapter and the next is something that neither Garrison nor Chiambra could have likely imagined at the time. But with the aid of extensive interviews plus declassified documents, for the first time, we will now outline a three-stage program to destruct Garrison's case and to make sure that Clay Shaw would be acquitted. This first stage began very early with Bernardo de Torres, a man who, while working with Mitch Werbel, may have been involved with Kennedy's murder. Parenthetically, as we have spoken of in the past, Mitch Werbel, a longtime CIA officer and a master of silenced weapons. Continuing. But it will continue with certain other singleton penetrations by people like William Gurvich, P-U-R-V-I-C-H, and Gordon Novell. The second stage of the effort will center around the wider efforts of former National Security Agency officer Walter Sheridan in alliance with the CIA and NBC. That effort was coupled with the work of intelligence assets and journalists, intelligence assets slash journalists, James Phelan, P-H-E-L-A-N, and Hugh Ainsworth, A-Y-N-E-S-W-R-R-T-H. When Garrison would still not give up, a third phase set in with two prongs to it. CIA officer James Angleton's counterintelligence office took over in September of 1967, and as we have previewed, Angleton's endeavor was then allied to and expanded all the way up to Director Richard Helms in 1968 and 1969. With operations that could not even be discussed in public or for the record, but which, as we shall see, House Select Committee Assistant Deputy House Select Committee on Assassinations Deputy Counsel Bob Tannenbaum saw certain documents about. And as I've said in the past, Jim, and as I will reiterate, I think for a contemporary audience, most of whom were not even born when Kennedy was killed, and who know what little they know about the assassination, through the distorting lens of media disinformation, I think understanding how not only the justice, the process of justice, but the relaying of events to the public have been fundamentally distorted in this process. I'd like to overlap this interview with some of the information that we spoke about last time and a few details that we missed. We spoke about Gordon Novell at some length, one of the agency infiltrators in the Garrison's office, worked with the aforementioned Walter Sheridan and others. We did not mention Novell, in addition to working directly with CIA and Alan Dulles, worked also with the FBI. Tell us about Novell and the FBI, Jim.
All right. As Gordon later revealed, on his first day at work for the DA's office, he came back to his apartment, and there were all kinds of FBI agents lollygagging around, like sitting in a car, standing across the street. Some of them were disguised as vagabonds, okay? And so he found out very quickly that the local FBI office was very interested in what he was finding out in his work for Jim Garrison. Now, I think it's pretty obvious why this would be important and why the FBI would want to do this because as long as Garrison was continuing his investigation, he was obviously punching holes in the Warren Commission report. And if you read the Warren Commission report, you'll see very quickly that I'd say offhand about 80% of what is in the Warren Commission comes from the FBI. So in other words, what Garrison was doing was punching holes in the credibility of J. Edgar Hoover and the Federal Bureau of Investigation, all right? And, of course, Hoover really didn't like that a heck of a lot. So that's why he wanted to know what the heck Garrison was up to. And, by the way, I should add that it wasn't just this way. It was also later revealed through an FBI employee by the name of William Walter that the FBI had also wired Garrison's phones, both at his office and at his home. All right?
Right.
And we know this because William Walter's fiancée at the time was typing out the transcripts, okay, to these conversations that the FBI was bugging. All right? And we also know through Garrison's children that the FBI would put physical surveillance, that is, people tailing Garrison in cars. This is, see, because, you know, Hoover took a great pride in the bureau he had built. And for whatever reason, he decided to go along with the cover-up to Kennedy's assassination. And a former FBI agent by the name of William Turner, who I had worked with before, said, in his opinion, the beginning of the decline of the FBI's reputation as a crime-solving unit came with their performance in the JFK case. Because he told me that, look, Jim, I worked for the FBI for 10 years, all right? This is the way you conducted an investigation. Number one, you collected all the relevant leads, all right? Then you followed out every single lead to its physical conclusion, where you couldn't follow it out anymore, all right? You then wrote a report based upon this that was not supposed to adjudicate the case, but was to provide only the information that you gathered and arrange it into some kind of cohesive whole. In my understanding, and he had friends in the FBI, I managed to get some of these documents, from what I saw, step two was never taken. All right? Most of the leads were not followed out to their logical conclusion. And then if you don't do that, then number three is a joke. Okay? And he said, look, FBI agents just don't act like that. For that to happen, there had to be some kind of clearance from the top that they were going to be able to do this. Now, what makes that even worse, of course, is that, remember what I said about the FBI report is not supposed to come to a conclusion as to guilt or innocence. Well, in this case, even though it was an incomplete investigation, they did come to a conclusion, namely that Oswald is guilty. All right? And so this is why Hoover was so worried about what Garrison was turning up.
And by the way, William Turner, known to this audience as the author of Power on the Right, co-author with John Christian of The Assassination of Robert F. Kennedy, and also co-author with, I've forgotten the guy's name, Hinkle of The Fish is Red. Was it Walter Hinkle, the editor of Ramparts? It was.
Warren Hinkle.
Warren Hinkle, excuse me. Yeah. And yes, he is absolutely correct. And indeed, I think beyond that, as we look at the intelligence services working hand in glove to infiltrate and subvert Garrison's investigation, and in turn sending media hatchet men to pervert the course of the investigation in their reportage to the public, working directly with intelligence services in so doing, and as we'll see, working directly with not only the intelligence services, but Clay Shaw's defense team to get Shaw off the hook. I think the paradigm that you set forth, Jim, really will apply to the credibility of this country as a whole. I remember Alan Dulles in one of the Warren Commission meetings saying that it was important that the U.S. not be seen as a banana republic.
That was actually McCloy.
Oh, was that McCloy? Okay. Thank you for correcting me. I was speaking of banana republics. He had his share in overthrowing a few of those. I would suggest that this country might be termed top banana republic. because really, if one examines the facts, and again, I think the integration of the media with all of these other power players that you have so masterfully set forth really is consummately important for those of us who want to understand our country. And it really is the credibility of the U.S. itself that is at stake here.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. Long article-length descriptions of the For the Record programs are available at spitfirelist.com, also featuring information that wasn't in the original program due to the limitations of time.
Moving from Gordon Novell, another person we spoke about last week but did not really talk about in connection with Guy Bannister, William Martin, who was another of the infiltrators, and he also is no stranger to other people whom we have spoken of in the past, like Guy Bannister.
See, William Martin, one of the things I did in my book, all right, is I tried to show how extensive Guy Bannister's intelligence network was in New Orleans. And one of the things that Guy Bannister did, all right, is that he recruited certain conservative students from local colleges, okay, down there in New Orleans. You had Loyola down there, you had Tulane down there, et cetera. All right, and so he would recruit these guys, pay them a pittance, okay, and get them indoctrinated into doing intelligence work for him, right? And some of these people were right in his office, like Dan and Alan Campbell, for example, all right? And there was William Martin, who he recruited, okay, out of college, all right, to do some spy work for him. And lo and behold, Martin continues that work later on after he graduated from law school, all right, when he offered his services to Jim Garrison, all right? So this is the kind of octopus that you had down there. And let me also add that in my book, I also show how Clay Shaw's lawyers were associated with Guy Bannister's network, okay? Because one of the things that Bannister did is that he was quite close to a guy named Guy Johnson, all right? Guy Johnson was a former Navy officer, later became ONI Reserve, was one of Clay Shaw's best friends and professional colleagues. And in fact, when Garrison first indicted Clay Shaw, Guy Johnson was to be part of the legal team, all right? Well, evidently what happened is that one of the things that happened is that Johnson was so obviously part of the intelligence network in New Orleans that the legal team decided he would be too much of a liability if it turned up that he was actually working in alliance with Bannister and Shaw. Because one of the sources later on that was in this intelligence community said, quite literally, that the intelligence network for New Orleans was made up of three principal players, and they were Guy Bannister, Clay Shaw, and Guy Johnson, all right? And also, the Wegmans, who were the real nexus, I would say, of the Shaw defense, they were also close to Guy Johnson, all right? And we've actually found letters from Bannister to that law firm, which the Wegmans were involved in with Guy Johnson, referring students for clearance, okay, to be used by Bannister in his intelligence network. Now, obviously, one of the real serious problems with Jim Garrison's case is that none of this information, to my knowledge, ever came out while the time that Garrison had indicted Shaw and all the way up to his trial. You know, but it was there. If you're any enterprising reporter who really wanted to do some shoe leather work, who wanted to do some knocking on some doors, who wanted to talk to some people, okay, off the beaten path, they could have found this stuff out. But to my knowledge, no reporter in that whole two-year period ever came up with this. The only guy who I believe knew about it was Bill Turner, okay, through his FBI contacts.
So basically you have one of the three people who was described as comprising the intel community in New Orleans, Guy Johnson, working as a defense attorney for one of the others, namely Clay Shaw, and in turn both had worked directly with Guy Bannister, the third person described as comprising the intel community, and
right.
William Martin, one of the infiltrators into Garrison's office, one of the nine alluded to in that passage I read at the beginning of our interview, was working for Guy Bannister. And again, the integration of the intelligence community, the defense team for Clay Shaw, and the media in order to pervert reality and corrupt our democracy. I think, again, well, certainly there's no more important part of your very important book, I think, for a contemporary audience. I'd like to review and go into greater depth, Jim, about a couple of the other key infiltrators. We will come back to them when we actually discuss a couple of the key hatchet men, media hatchet men, when we discuss Clay Shaw's actual trial. Tell us about Hugh Ainsworth. First of all, his links to the intel community and some of what he then did as one of the perverters of journalistic reality.
Oh, my God, where do you begin with this guy? You know, in my opinion, Hugh Ainsworth was one of the worst of the worst. And, you know, he has never, ever come clean, you know, as to who he really is, okay, and what he really did.
Tell us about him and J. Walton Moore. That might be a good place to begin.
Okay, now what's important about that, of course, is him and J. Walton Moore, all right, is that that happened before the Kennedy assassination. In other words, he went into the CIA station, okay, in Dallas, which was headed by a guy named J. Walton Moore, all right, and he said he was taking a trip to Cuba, and he volunteered his services, okay, at that time to the CIA. Now, unfortunately, we've only been able to find the application, okay? I've never been able to find the actual. See, there's a form or that the CIA will fill out, and it describes how they used you. Okay? Were you a witting asset? Were you an unwitting asset? Okay, did you actually make it as an agent, et cetera? I've never been able to find that about Ainsworth. But it's very obvious that they used him because later on, of course, when he was ostensibly working as a reporter in New Orleans covering the Garrison case, all right, he tried to bribe a witness, John Manchester, up in the Clinton-Jackson area, telling him he could get him a job with the CIA, okay, at $37,000 a year. Now, remember, that might not sound like a lot of money now, but this is 1967. Okay, you factor in inflation, you're talking some big money.
Yeah, oh, definitely.
Okay.
Definitely.
Yeah, all right. And so, and I'll never forget what Manchester told him. He said, Mr. Ainsworth, if you start running right now, I might not be able to put an axe up your butt. Okay.
Yep.
I love those simple country people.
Yeah.
Okay.
Really. That is a case of asking me no questions, and I will tell no lies. Yep. Tell us about.
All right. So that's just one aspect of Ainsworth's horrendous record. But a very important thing to remember is that he was working for one of the local newspapers, the Dallas Morning News, the day that Kennedy was killed. Okay? And Ainsworth was very active with the Warren Commission, if you can believe it. Okay? He was determined, bound and determined, okay, that they would come down as hard as they could on Oswald as the lone assassin. And this was in the summer of 1964. He had a close association with Marina Oswald, all right? And he wanted them to buy this preposterous story that Marina was trying to say that somehow Oswald had also threatened to kill Richard Nixon. Now, to show you how absurd that is, not even the Warren Commission would buy that one. Okay? All right? Not even the Warren Commission would buy that one.
That really is a very strong modifier, because if the Warren Commission wouldn't buy it, what that means is that wasn't even a good fairy tale.
Right, exactly, because they printed everything from the Brothers Grimm, all right? Okay, so anyway, he went ahead and he sold Oswald's phony diary, okay, for money, and split the proceeds, I think, between him and William Alexander. Okay, who was a DA on the Dallas legal team at the time. All right. Now, to show you how absurd the whole Richard Nixon thing was, Marina would have had to lock Oswald in the bathroom. Okay? Because that's what she said happened. All right. Well, the problem with that is the bathroom locked from the inside. Okay? And also, Nixon was not even in Dallas until several months after Marina said the incident occurred. Okay? So this is how absurd. You know, I strongly suspect Ainsworth urged these stories on Marina Oswald. Okay? All right. Now, right after this, Ainsworth began another thing that he was doing. All right. He began to go ahead and attack the critics of the Warren Commission report. The Morning News published a review of Joachim Jostein's early book on the case, Oswald, Assassin or Fall Guy. And I have to say, in my older days when I first got into this stuff, that's a remarkable book. For 1964, it's a very perceptive and detailed book, all right? Well, Ainsworth's review was not really a review. It was nothing but, you know, a smear, okay, of Jostein's book, full of invective, all right, and trying to dismantle everything that Jostein said in that book, which a lot of what he said ended up coming true.
By the way, Jim, very briefly, there is a declassified CIA memorandum about how to discredit Warren Commission critics, and one of the people they specifically targeted was Joe Yostin, and in order to smear him, they took a Gestapo memo from the Third Reich maintaining that he had been a member of the German Communist Party. So it's interesting to twine that with Hugh Ainsworth's behavior. Go ahead.
Right, exactly correct. All right. Now, another thing is somehow Ainsworth infiltrated the Life magazine. Life magazine was doing a reinvestigation of the Kennedy case in the latter part of 1966. Okay? And somehow Ainsworth got in on this. Okay? Or he said he was a part of it. All right? And this was the problem back with that team that they assembled, is that Holland McCombs, who was a high-up reporter for Life magazine, ended up being a good friend of Clay Shaw. So as Garrison, who they were talking to at the time, began to close in on Shaw, Life magazine began to distance itself from the Kennedy assassination. But Ainsworth did get an interview with Garrison relatively early, and a long time ago I had his notes on that interview, and he said words to the effect, which I remember distinctly, we can't let Garrison know we're playing both sides, okay, which is classic Ainsworth, all right, then, of course, what he did is he went ahead and began to smear another critic, okay, which, of course, was Mark Lane. These guys absolutely despised Mark Lane. Okay, he handed in a report to the Bureau saying that Mark Lane was a homosexual and he had to drop his political career because of those allegations. And like these guys always do, they also write in their report, please do not disclose that I'm the source for this information. Okay? All right? They never want to be exposed as what they are. All right? Now, Ainsworth then, of course, went ahead and published one of the most vitriolic attacks on Garrison through the auspices of Newsweek, you know, in which he depicted Garrison as a wild man, that people in New Orleans are, terrified of his reign of terror and of what he's going to do, et cetera. Okay. Now, that report... which was going to be published in Newsweek, I believe, in May of 1967, Ainsworth sent advance copies to both the FBI and the White House. And, of course, as he always did, he said, please do not tell anybody that I'm sending you my work in advance. All right? Okay, well, somebody later on, I think in 91 or 92, because I had found the FBI memo on this that had been declassified, right, and confronted him, and he asked him, did you ever show your work in advance to the FBI or the White House? And, of course, what these guys always do, they lie their head off in public. All right, he says, well, no. And so, and then he read him the declassified FBI memo, okay? All right, these guys always like to lie about their duplicity, okay? So it's always fun to catch them, all right, in the act. Now, Ainsworth, the remarkable thing about Ainsworth, and again, I would have never known this except for the work of the Assassinations Record Review Board, is that he went on working hand in glove with Clay Shaw's lawyers, not just for the initial trial, which was in 69, but all the way up until when Garrison indicted Shaw for perjury. And I've actually read a lot of his stuff. And in other words, he was working with Shaw's lawyers from 1967 to 1971. Now, what makes that so puzzling is that I could only find one report that he had published at that time in either a magazine or a newspaper, which was in Newsweek in May of 67. So here's my question. Who was paying him to do nothing? In other words, reporters are supposed to get paid because they write reports. If Ainsworth was publishing little or nothing, what was he getting paid for?
Indeed, right. It brings to mind the mysterious remuneration of Gordon Novell that we spoke about last week. And also,
right.
I think another thing that should be mentioned in the context of Ainsworth working to discredit Garrison all the way through 71 is the Helms observation that we need to work to discredit Garrison or neutralize the trial before, during, and after the trial
right.
of Clay Shaw. So that
right.
is something else I think would give us some perspective. Also, I think in connection with Ainsworth and Life magazine was no impartial observer. I remember as a kid looking at the cover of the Life issue with that doctored picture of Lee Harvey Oswald holding the, apparently Oswald's head spliced onto that with the shadows going in different directions. I call that the Leaning Tower of Oswald. You know, it's got Oswald leaning at that ridiculous angle. And it's obvious it's not just a doctored photo, but a badly doctored photo. And yet, this was on the cover of Henry Luce's magazine. So
See, in 1979, Ainsworth did an interview on a local TV show, all right? And he admitted there, quote, "I'm not saying there wasn't a conspiracy. I know most people in this country believe there was a conspiracy. I just refuse to accept it, and that's my life's work," unquote. In other words, the facts of the case don't really matter to him. All right, it's keeping a lid on the conspiracy that matters. Okay? You know, I would have loved to have seen somebody confront him with that on network television. Wouldn't that have been great?
Yeah.
Well,
you know,
What the heck do you mean by that?
You know, I think, Jim, that is a very revealing statement by Ainsworth, and I think it really goes to the core of an awful lot of the perpetuation of the big lie, not just in the JFK case, but others. Once the media have gone on record and have disseminated a bunch of nonsense, the successful career of any given reporter or editor or what have you depends on continuing to disseminate the official disinformation, because if you begin telling the truth, there is an old Turkish proverb, he who tells the truth gets chased out of nine villages. And I think they don't want to get chased out of the village, and that's how they keep the paychecks coming in. So at least we owe him that. Briefly, Jim, if you would review Ainsworth's behavior vis-a-vis Sergio Arcacha-Smith.
We talked about that last week.
We did.
Okay, he actually went to Dallas. Okay, and now, by the way, I should add something in here. The reason that Ainsworth was able to do these kind of things is because, as we revealed earlier in the show today, there were a number of double agents inside Garrison's office, okay? And Ainsworth was aware of this, and he was working with them. So, in other words, when Garrison would get a lead on a witness, somebody in the office would tell Ainsworth, and Ainsworth would be able to head him off at the pass, okay? And he did this more than once, all right? I know this for a fact because it's been declassified now. In the case of Arcacha-Smith, he went into the Dallas police, and he counseled Sergio Arcacha-Smith, and he gave him all these warnings about how Garrison was a madman. You know, he had Arcacha-Smith fingered as one of the conspirators, and he said, "You can't talk to this guy alone," all right? And so he got Arkachi Smith to insist that in any interview that he did with Garrison, it be done at the police station with William Alexander as his attorney. Okay. Now, Alexander was one of these right-wing nuts, okay, who once said about the single bullet theory, well, it's like the Immaculate Conception. You either believe it or you don't, okay? And so that's what Alexander's job was, all right? And so once Garrison's lawyers got there to Dallas, Arkachi Smith had the whole thing rigged, all right? And they decided not to do the interview with Arkachi Smith. But after they left, Ainsworth came out of the woodwork, and he went ahead and started counseling the police not to cooperate with Garrison anymore. And this is one of the ways, of course, that, because in my book I devote a lot of time to this, how Garrison's subpoenas and his requests for extradition were almost never honored. In fact, I don't think they were honored at all. And this is one of the ways that it was done. Because, of course, Dallas was an important place for Garrison to get some evidence and witnesses from. All right, and this is how Garrison was again cut off at the pass with both witnesses and extradition requests.
Now, we'll get eventually to the role of the Attorney General at the time, but let's hold that in abeyance till we arrive at that point, because this is a fellow who has very much emerged as a hero to the so-called progressive sector, Ramsey Clark. We'll get to him later. Another fellow we spoke about last week, Jim, I'd like to develop his activities at greater length, and that is James Phelan, P-H-E-L-A-N, something of a parallel operator for Ainsworth, or to Ainsworth, I should say.
All right. Jim Phelan was a guy who I actually had some talks with because I was really the first guy to go after Phelan. I just smelled a rat in there someplace. All right. And so I began to write negatively about Phelan. He got very upset about it. All right. And it turned out that I ended up being correct about this. And so some of the declassified files of the ARB show that, like Hugh Ainsworth, that Phelan was informing to the FBI about the Garrison investigation. All right. And he was working with the Saturday Evening Post, and it later turned out that the Post had some interesting connections with government agencies, all right, and that Phelan had done this kind of work previously with the FDA, who wanted him to do a hit piece on who's that guy who started Scientology? Ron Hubbard?
Yes, L. Ron Hubbard, yes.
Yeah, right, and they wanted him to do a hit piece, and he did. And then, of course, he denied that he did it, except the guy had all the documents and exposed him as a liar. All right, well, that's what he did with me. He tried to say he never had any association with the FBI. The documents came out, and he still tried to deny it. All right? And so he also had a close association with a guy who's been absolute poison on the JFK case, a guy named Bob Loomis. All right? If you don't know who Bob Loomis was, he's retired now. Bob Loomis was one of the most famous, I would call him infamous, book editors who ever lived. All right? He was very powerful, very influential. And he made his life work to go ahead and keep the lid on these assassinations, all right? And so, for example, he sponsored Bill Houghton's book on the RFK case, all right, called Special Unit Senator, which is nothing but a cover-up book, all right? Then, after Oliver Stone came out with his film, JFK, Loomis sponsored Gerald Posner to go ahead and come out with his god-awful book, Case Closed, to keep the lid on the JFK case. Well, Phelan was a friend of Loomis's. Okay, it turns out later, all right? And so that, of course, would be a kind of natural association, okay? So no mystery about that. I later found out something even weirder about James Phelan. During the trial of Clay Shaw, there seemed to be a kind of almost homogenized, fabricated synchronicity of reporting about, because there were some really interesting things that came out of that trial, which we'll get to, all right? But the public never learned any of it. And so it always puzzled me as to how that happened. Well, I found out how it happened. Phelan was at the trial. Now, what makes that kind of odd is that Phelan never wrote about the trial. So, in other words, what was he doing there? Sort of like Ainsworth. What was Ainsworth doing in New Orleans for 3 years if he wasn't writing about the case? Well, what was Phelan doing at the trial if he never wrote about the trial? Okay, well, it turned out that Phelan was there because, for example, if you were going to report on a famous trial, you know, and you were a sponsored reporter, your employer would get you a room maybe at the Holiday Inn or something, okay? Well, Phelan had a house, okay? He had a rather large home, which he invited all the reporters after each day's proceedings to come into, and he would serve them refreshments, you know, wine and cheese and things like that. And he would then go ahead and tell them what the next day's spin should be in their news stories. All right? Now, how do I know this? I know this from two sources. Okay, there's a guy named Art Kunkin, who published LA Free Press.
Correct.
was there, okay? And there were two reporters from TASS, the Soviet newspaper organization, that were in New Orleans. And they wrote about this phenomenon also, okay? On the day that Garrison showed the Zapruder film, everybody was stunned, okay? Because that was the first time anybody had ever seen this thing, all right? And the jury was stunned by the film. They demanded to see it, I think, 9 times. Because, of course, everything that Garrison was saying was now true.
Yeah, the Zapruder film, Abraham Zapruder was making, I think it was an 8mm amateur film of the motorcade and captured the assassination. And JFK, quite obviously, is hit from the front and his body is thrown violently backward. And there is no way anybody who knows anything about firearms, there was no way he could have been shot from behind and his whole body thrown violently. And it appears, you know, several feet in terms of distance behind, his body is knocked behind him and to the left, and his head just explodes all over the back of the limousine. And there is no way in hell that could have come from a shot from behind. And anyone with one good eye and half a brain would figure that out if they saw the film.
Correct, correct. And so, if you can believe this, that night, James Phelan, who was supposed to be a reporter, mapped out the first version of the jet effect on his chalkboard. He brought a chalkboard out, got a piece of chalk, and went ahead and mapped out this loony idea about the jet effect causing Kennedy's rapid movement to the back and to the left. Now, should I explain that, or do your listeners know what that means with the jet effect?
No, I think you should do that. Explain it, please.
I'm sorry, I can't help but laughing, you know, whenever I... Okay.
Well, no, as Nietzsche said, a joke is the epigram on the death of a feeling. So laughter is understandable when you're talking about something like the jet effect. Go ahead, Jim.
Okay, this is what the jet effect says. The jet effect says that the blood and tissue that went ahead and ejected itself out of Kennedy's skull went ahead and created a chasm through the brain, which conducted a kind of effect through Kennedy's skull and went ahead and rocketed him backwards into the back seat of the car with such force that he literally bounces off the back seat. Okay? Now, how on earth is Phelan to come up with something like that in a matter of hours? Okay? A guy who, to my knowledge, never had any scientific training, you know, that tells you how plugged in he was to the establishment. Because obviously, somebody got on the phone, either the CIA or the FBI, and said, we got to have some piece of malarkey to try and explain away what the jury and the reporters just saw. And they got on the phone to, like, say some high-tech, you know, Lawrence Livermore lab or something, and they go, okay, make up something, okay, so we can give it to this Phelan guy down in New Orleans. And that's obviously what happened, you know. But that shows you, I mean, if anything shows you, the links to which the powers that be would go to attack Garrison and keep the lid on this case, I think that should tell you about everything. You know, it's kind of shocking when you think of it.
And again, underscoring the point that you made in the paragraphs that I read from pages 228 and 229, what we're looking at are not only the work of infiltrators in the Garrison's investigation, working with the intelligence community, but also working with the media hatchet men, who in turn are working with the intelligence community, and in the case of Ainsworth and James Phelan, working directly with Clay Shaw's defense team.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. All of Dave Emery's 36 years of work is available for download on the SpitfireList.com website. The site includes many articles not included in the programs, as well as a small library of old anti-fascist books. All of the material on the website is available for free. Sister station WFMU is podcasting the For the Record programs. To subscribe to the podcast, use the link at the top of the description for this program or on the front page.
Jim, last week you mentioned that Phelan did a hit piece for the Saturday Evening Post, and the Three Eyes Intel Front, turned out to be a CIA front, was run by Walter Sheridan, or it certainly was under his command, another intel, veteran intel officer, ONI, FBI, counterintelligence for the NSA. And one of those guys named Birch, B-E-U-R-T, Ser Vas, capital S-E-R, capital V-A-S, eventually bought the Saturday Evening Post. Do you know if he was the owner at the time that Phelan published his hit piece?
No, I don't know that for sure.
Okay, I'm just an inquiry. And again, I think for people who are looking at the investigation from our vantage point in 2019, in particular young people, and the median age of Americans is about 37 or 38 years of age, this is the distorted prism through which our history is being presented. And our, quote, journalism, unquote, really functions as an extension of a corrupt media establishment. Jim, we've got about 6 minutes, and I think as something of a bridge to somebody I'd like to talk about in our next interview. And again, bearing in mind for younger people, there was an article in the Huffington Post of October 21st of 2016. It's by a guy named Rodney Wilson, whom I've never heard of. He is described as a teacher, and this is on the occasion of LGBT History Month, and it's called The Gay Man Charged in the Assassination of JFK. Just reading a couple of paragraphs. John Fitzgerald Kennedy's assassin was gunned down before he could be held accountable for the murder of the president. Only one person was ever tried for complicity in the events of November 1963, a gay man named Clay Shaw. Clay Laverne Shaw was born in a small town. It talks about his CV. And it says, when the 46-year-old president was assassinated in Dallas, 50-year-old Shaw was nowhere near the Texas School Book Depository building. Well, we know where he was. He was in San Francisco via prior appointment. But through an odd series of happenstance and conspiratorial allegations cobbled together out of not much more than thin air by the inexact New Orleans District Attorney Jim Garrison, Shaw in 1967 was charged with participating in a CIA and or FBI and or Cuban-backed right and or left-wing conspiracy to assassinate the president. And then it goes on to cite not only James Phelan, but it talks about the assertion by – oh, actually, it does. Let me read this paragraph. D.A. Garrison rejected the findings of the Warren Commission's lone gunman theory and believed, according to the investigative journalist James Phelan, that the Kennedy assassination involved a complex conspiracy that included Clay Shaw and a possible homosexual plot or homosexual thrill killing, whatever that is. And goes on to talk about how Johnny Carson ripped Jim Garrison apart, and goes on to disseminate the cover story that Clay Shaw admired Kennedy and he was a Wilsonian FDR liberal, etc.
Oh my God, they printed all that stuff?
Well, they did, and that's the reason. And again, if you'd like to do it, I'm not necessarily casting aspersions on Rodney Wilson. I never heard of the guy. He may just have been reading the established journalistic record. But the point is, yeah, this was from the Huffington Post from October of 2016, and it makes Clay Shaw out to be a gay martyr, you know, being persecuted by Jim Garrison, you know, and citing James Phelan and talking about how somehow Garrison saw the Kennedy assassination as a homosexual thrill killing, which is just an absolute lie. But this is why I think it's one of the main reasons why I think your book is so important for a contemporary audience, because those of us who studied the assassination for years know what happened, but with your book, it's like an ant farm. We know what happened, but you've shown us the ants at work digging through the sand and building up their tunnels and doing what they did to create the fantasy. But unfortunately, young people reading the Huffington Post would know nothing but James Phelan's disinformation. I'd like to talk more about that and beginning our next talk, Jim, with James Kirkwood. You, however, in addition to Destiny Betrayed, also have JFK The Evidence Today. Tell us about that and where they can get both books, and Kennedy's and King and Black Op Radio.
All right. My most recent book is called The JFK Assassination, The Evidence Today, and I wrote that after the new and revised edition of Destiny Betrayed. If you go to my website, kennedysandking.com, you can go ahead and you'll see ways to go ahead and purchase both of those books. I'm also a semi-regular on Leno Sanek's internet radio show, okay, out of Vancouver, called Black Op Radio.
All righty. So that is where people can go to order the books, which I would recommend they do, and to find out more from Jim DiGiamio. We'll continue with our analysis of the synthesis of criminal wrongdoing from the government, the intel services, the infiltrators in the garrison's investigation, their networking with the media people, and the utter perversion of political reality and history itself in our next talk. However, this concludes For the Record program number 1046, interview number 15 with Jim DiGiamio about Destiny Betrayed. For Jim DiGiamio, this is Dave Emery saying thanks for listening.